Episode 27, July the 12th, 2009. Astronomy on the Web. Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a not-for-profit astronomy podcast produced by me, Gurubir Singh, an amateur astronomer in the UK. For more details, see the About and FAQ pages at www.astrotalkuk.org. A different and at times silly, interesting and fun episode this week. If you listen to astronomy podcasts, this should be a familiar voice. If not, the introduction is a couple of minutes into the episode. In this conversation, I hope to meander around a few different topics, including AstronomyCast, of course, podcasting, distant learning, women in astronomy, science and politics, and of course, it'll be impossible not to talk about some aspect of astronomy. So we'll see how we go. Somebody who works a lot with RR Lyra stars, you have a lot of contact with amateur astronomers. You need their help.
Yes.
How come?
Well, so there's lots and lots of telescopes around the world that are really big and really good at looking very faint objects far, far away. But these giant professional telescopes aren't well suited for looking at the nearby stars that happen to be fairly bright. And so to get the data I need, I need night after night after night. And the data can come just as easily from an amateur as it could from a professional. And a lot of the professional telescopes just, I'd blind them with the stars I'm interested in looking at.
So you obviously have a lot of contact with the amateur astronomy world. Maybe you still are an amateur astronomer?
I think a lot of professionals got their start going out and looking up with binoculars, with backyard telescopes. I got my first telescope when I was in middle school, and I remember freezing to death during Massachusetts winters trying to find Andromeda, trying to look at the Orion Nebula, and just peering around the sky with my own little 4-inch Newtonian.
Okay, now you should have recognized that voice. That indeed was and is Dr. Pamela L. Gay, astronomer, a writer, a podcaster, face of AstronomyCast. And for those of you who didn't recognize that voice, you should be ashamed of yourself. Go and have a look at astronomycast.com and, of course, starstrider.com as well. So, Professor Pamela L. Gay, what does the L stand for?
It stands for Lynn. It's a overly common American middle name for girls born in the 70s.
The first episode of AstronomyCast started way back in 2006. How did it all start?
It actually, Phil Plait is to blame. This is the bad astronomer. He's actually a really good friend of mine. When I was moving out to the Midwest from Boston, Slacker Astronomy was going through a bunch of different change of life for several of the people involved, and we decided to split the show, and Slacker Astronomy went on with a new format, and I was looking to keep going with a weekly show, and I asked Phil if he was interested in doing something with me, and he said no, but I have this friend, Fraser Kane, who does Universe Today, and I'd known Fraser from we'd done some collections of Astronomy New Media People Doom episodes of Slacker Astronomy, and Phil said, Fraser wants to start a weekly podcast, why don't you go and talk with him? And so Phil was our matchmaker, and about 2 weeks later, we went live with our very first episode, which was on Pluto and why Pluto isn't a planet.
How does it work? You are in the US.
Yeah.
Fraser is in Vancouver, Canada. Mm-hmm. So how do you actually get together on a regular basis?
Well, this is the wonders of the internet. We use Skype for everything. We record individually on our own computers using GarageBand. But to talk to each other, we just regularly open up a Skype window. And I've actually met both of his children by video chatting with them. And I did finally meet them in person recently. But he and I have been talking over Skype just matter-of-factly off and on throughout the days going across these couple of different years.
How's Fraser's brother Niles getting on with Daphne?
No, wrong Fraser. Sorry.
Okay. Now, you work at the Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
Is that the home of Swinburne Astronomy Online?
No, those are actually two totally unrelated projects. Oh. Swinburne Astronomy Online is associated with the Swinburne University of Technology down in Australia. And I've been working with that project since 2000. They hire astronomers all over the globe to work with their distance learning program. So I'm working with an Australian university living in Illinois, USA, and I've had students from Paraguay, from Italy, from really all corners of the earth. I've had Indonesian students. I've had, if they have an internet connection, they could potentially be one of my students, and where they're using their own personal telescopes to collect data and do research projects to work on their master's degree. Astronomers most interested in working in distance learning from around the globe, with people most interested in doing the learning from around the globe, and we're doing all of it through an Australian school.
Okay, politics and science. Now, you have your man in the White House now,
yes.
The erstwhile Senator of Illinois, Barack Obama, is your president. One of the things he said is that we will restore science to its rightful place. Perhaps it's too early to say, but can you see any evidence of that in the way, perhaps the funding and the policies that you may come across?
Well, I think funding we're still working on sorting out. One of the problems with the United States is it's designed to slow people down. Our country designed its legislation and its executive branch and its courts so that nothing could be changed radically, rapidly. Mm. But what we're seeing is changes in policy. Under the Bush administration, there was strong censoring of things that were coming out of scientists. There was censoring of policy documents. You couldn't discuss global warming. You couldn't consider stem cell initiatives. There was a lot of restricting what could be thought about within the science community. And under Obama, he wants the facts versus the emotions to lead the way. And so the door has been opened to have honest discussions about global warming, to have honest discussions about evolution, to have honest discussions about cosmology that are based strictly on facts. What are the observables? What can we see? What do the experiments say? And that basing science on, well, scientific evidence, that's a wonderful change in policy that I wholeheartedly support. And it looks like there's going to be a lot of new funding going into the National Science Foundation as part of the upcoming stimulus package. And, you know, we need money in science.
And no doubt you and Fraser will keep us posted on the projects that arise as a result. You're a woman.
Yes.
So all my scientific training was useful. And anecdotally, when I go around England to various clubs and societies, I see many more women in the amateur field as well as the professional arena. Do you see that in the U.S.?
We still have very, very few amateur astronomers who are women. This is just, it takes time to change things. So you're seeing more girls in the astronomy high school clubs, in college majors. But at the middle-aged level, kids gone away to college, spending the excess income on telescope equipment, it's still something that's dominated by men. But you're starting to see, rather than men bringing their wives to astronomy star parties, you are starting to see the wives bringing their husbands to the star parties. And it's a wonderful change. But it's a slow one. It's happening, but it's now gone from seeing zero women to seeing two or three. It takes time.
It's certainly moving in the right direction.
Yes.
Talking about minorities, one of the contributors to AstroTalk UK, Martin Lunn, on episode 11, said something that's quite interesting. He said he goes up and down speaking on astronomy in England. And he said that the kind of people he saw, they tended to be white, middle class, and male. You visit clubs and societies and star parties. Mm-hmm. How are the people in America represented? For example, do you see women, Afro-Caribbeans, Hispanics, Chinese, Americans, and range of ages and social groups?
The majority are, sadly, the gray-haired white male. It's a noble race that just keeps going in large numbers. There are minorities, thankfully. There are women, but both are minorities. part of this comes from astronomy isn't exactly an inexpensive hobby. You can do a lot by going outside and looking up with binoculars, looking up with your unaided eye. But traditionally, a lot of the amateur astronomy work that's been cutting edge has been done by people who are out there spending their excess income on buying expensive telescopes, buying expensive cameras. And I think what we're seeing in part is the economic divide, where you do see more middle-class whites than middle-class African-Americans, and that's in part reflected in the astronomy clubs. And there's also just not a lot of role models. When a kid is trying to figure out what are my hobbies, what am I interested in, they pick up what the entertainers they like are interested in. They pick up what their heroes are interested in. Luckily, we do in America have two wonderful African-American leaders in astronomy. We have Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's regularly on television, who's doing the NOVA series, who's appears on the Letterman show, and he's a great spokesperson for our entire field. He's very elegant. We also have Derek Pitts, who's coming out of the Cincinnati Planetarium, an observatory, and he's another very well-spoken African-American who's out there saying, look, here's the facts, here's the science, let me share it with you in an interesting way. And he's providing another really well-educated role model for a new population of people who might not have had a role model before.
Bit of astronomy. Exoplanets.
Yes.
Kepler's going to be launched in a few days. It's going to be looking for Earth-like planets. Mm-hmm. How will what it does be different from what Caro did? The European...
Right. So I believe that Kepler has a much higher sensitivity. I have to admit, I'm not as familiar with Caro. Kepler, it's looking at the same field on the sky over and over and over and over, and it's going to be exceedingly sensitive to planets transiting in front of their parent star. And by looking for the slight variations in light coming from the parent star, we'll be able to say, oh, there's probably a planet there. And by looking for repeats of these slight changes, we'll be able to identify individual planets that are going around more than once, and hopefully multiple planets going around more than once. It has a new higher resolution and higher sensitivity.
I understand it's going to be in orbit for about 3.5 years.
Yeah.
Okay, a bit of speculation now. Imagine we're going into time machine and it's 3.5 years later and Kepler's found quite a lot of planets that are Earth-like. And it's going to be the job then of Earth-based maps by then, other space-based telescopes to take a closer look. Way back in 1960s, when Frank Drake first came up with the famous Drake equation, one of the elements of that was the number of Earth-like planets. Now, since the 60s and what Kepler will have done in 3 years' time, there's a lot more information providing a bit more quantitative element to each of the bits of the Great Drake equation. Given all that, how's your sense? What do you feel about the likelihood of finding life, primitive life, within the next decade or so, bearing in mind the announcement of methane detected by the rovers and the Martian orbiters only a few months ago?
I really expect that at some point in my lifetime we'll have conclusive evidence that there's at least bacteria-based life somewhere else other than the planet Earth. Whether it's elsewhere in our solar system, around other stars, neither would particularly surprise me. There's many places within our own solar system where life could be supported. And with all the other planets out there, the idea of there being algae, the idea of there being bacteria, I really wouldn't be surprised with those discoveries. It's, are there going to be other intelligent lives that are capable of forming civilizations that don't self-destruct in any of many interesting ways? That's where it starts to get harder, and where we also don't know how do we prove that those exist. It's easy to say, based on oxygen and other chemicals and atmospheres, that that planet has life of some sort. Saying that planet has advanced societies, that starts to become much more complicated.
Well, we'll deal with intelligent societies next time, but it's really quite a profound thing to say, to hear from a practicing astronomer, that within the next decade or so, we will detect life in places outside the Earth. Now, for me, associated with astronomy for about 3 decades, it's quite an astounding position to be in, which is really refreshing. So thank you for that. I agree with you. I think we are going to be looking for some exciting news in the years to come. Finally, the state of science. Now, despite your weekly fact-based program, Astronomy Cast, there's still a lot of UFOs, astrology, conspiracy theorists, for example, and of course the intelligent design and creationism. Is science is under fire, and it's particularly so in technological societies like the US and here in Europe. Do you despair of that?
It gets very discouraging at times, because there are so many people that for a variety of different reasons start seeing science as a belief system rather than a system based on facts and rules and laws that are built into the universe rather than built into the human mind. As we've become more accepting of various points of philosophical view as societies, some people have taken this to a new extreme, saying that just as I should be accepting of various religious viewpoints, I should be accepting of various science and non-science viewpoints. And I have a problem with that. I can test astronomy, I can test physics, I can test particle physics, and say the rules that I come up with are based on something that I have no moral belief code in. It's simply, this is how our universe works. These are the equations that make it go. I can't use physics to prove or disprove God. That's a belief system that's a non-testable system. You can't try and govern something that is emotional and philosophical in context the same way you try and govern something that defines whether my keys are going to fall to the floor when dropped or not. Multiculturalism sometimes gets taken to too far of an extreme, and emotions get in the way of logic. We're human beings. I hope that by increasing education, by increasing knowledge of the scientific method, and that this isn't people making up philosophical viewpoints of the universe. We aren't Hume. We're basing what we say on apples falling from trees and the moon falling around the planet Earth. It's different.
Here's a question, but it's a joke. Okay. Just so we finish on a lighter point. How many astronomers does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know. How many?
None. They like the dark.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Pamela Gay, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you.
This week's quote is from Anne Morrow Lindberg. Good communication is as stimulating as black coffee, and just as hard to sleep after.